Good afternoon, and welcome to the start of the 2006 series of Fireside Chats, broadcast live on www.sechistorical.org and archived in the Virtual Museum of SEC and Securities History. I'm Teresa Gabaldon, Professor of Law and Carville Dickinson Benson Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School and host of the chats this year. www.sechistorical.org is under the jurisdiction of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society, a nonprofit organization separate from and independent of the SEC. The Virtual Museum and Archive, free and available worldwide 24/7, offers a growing collection of primary materials and information on the impact the SEC has had on national and international capital markets since its inception. The Society receives no federal funding. We are grateful for the sustained support of Pfizer, Inc., which is continuing its sponsorship of the Fireside Chat series in 2006. Today's Fireside Chat, along with our chat next week, will explore some aspects of the critical role of the Internet in the capital markets. Today's chat looks at online fraud. Our panelist today is John Reed Stark, Chief of the Office of Internet Enforcement in the SEC's Division of Enforcement. Mr. Stark was appointed to direct the SEC's Internet program in 1995. He now oversees a team of about 25 professionals who investigate and prosecute securities violations which involve technology. Mr. Stark is also an adjunct professor of law at the Georgetown University Law Center. The remarks made today are solely those of the speakers and are not representative of the society. Our speakers cannot give investment or legal advice. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Teresa.
Would you mind starting us off with a brief history of the Office of Internet Enforcement, perhaps including whose idea it was?
Sure. Well, it really started with myself and a fellow by the name of Dave Gianfrido, who still works with us now in the Office of Internet Enforcement, back in 1994, 1995. We started seeing that the Internet was being used more and more, and the Commission and the Division of Enforcement had gotten its first terminal with Internet access. And I drafted an actual white paper saying, well, here's what I think the SEC should do with respect to the Internet. And then Dave Gianfrido, who's a much better writer than I am, actually edited it for me. And we put it in a binder, and we circulated to about 20 or 25 senior executives at the SEC. And a few of them really responded, and one of them, a guy named Gary Sundick, said, John, why don't you become this Internet person? We won't pay you anymore, but we'll let you, and we won't necessarily give you the window office, but we'll let you explore this new area and maybe help us. And that's when it really began to take off. And then when Dick Walker became director, he, in 1998, decided to create an Office of Internet Enforcement with the support at that time of Chairman Leavitt. And he made me chief, and then he also gave me a deputy chief at the time. And the office has since grown really dramatically since that time. So it started with just an idea and I think a lot of enthusiasm, and then it grew to a real program segment that we're real proud of.
When you got it all started, did you yourself have some particular Internet proficiency?
Not a lot. You know, I think I considered myself a fairly sophisticated computer user, and I had some technology training. But really, I just was very excited about the medium. I knew that it was going to provide an opportunity for really instantaneous access to government by its citizenry, which I thought was terrific. And I wanted to be a part of getting out of the way. I think for the SEC, with respect to technology, a big thing you have to do is really get out of the way and let the technology flourish. You just have to step in when people are going to use the Internet to lie or to cheat or steal. But otherwise, you want to make sure that the free market of the Internet, the culture of the Internet, that you're not really disturbing that.
Lying, cheating, and stealing sound like activities that have been common for centuries. Is there something different about fraud on the Internet than the kinds of fraud we're more customarily accustomed to?
Well, looking back now that we've done close to 500 or so Internet-related actions, charging probably 1,200 or 1,300 individuals and entities,
I would say that it's really old wine in new bottles. Most of the time, it's really market manipulations, offering frauds. Spam campaigns are really just one component of a market manipulation, for example. The one area that's very different is when you sort of combine hacking, identity theft, and securities fraud. I think that's fairly unique. But most of the cases we've done, we use, for example, the traditional statutory weaponry of the SEC. We really haven't relied on any new rules or regulations or anything, and we really haven't needed any. And in fact, the Internet program has breathed new life into some statutes that had previously lied dormant. For example, Securities Act of 33 has a Section 17B, which prohibits promoting a company without disclosing the nature, source, and amount of compensation. There's not a lot of commentary written under the statute, and it was written a long time ago. And the SEC had brought in some cases involving radio promotions and a few others. It was really a statute designed to stop the tipsters who were standing outside the New York Stock Exchange floating around paper promotional materials. But back in 1998, again working for Dick Walker, we looked at that statute and we realized a lot of people were promoting stocks on the Internet without disclosing the nature, source, and amount of the compensation they were receiving. You know, their advice wasn't objective, and it's a strict liability statute. So we did a sweep of all, I think we filed about 23 actions involving 17B in 98, and since then we've brought a lot more. So if anything, I think the laws can always be improved. You know, I think laws can always be made better. It's important for the SEC in all the time to be thinking of what do we need to tell Congress to better equip ourselves. But generally, the statutes that are in place now have worked pretty well.
Well, that is the answer, I think, to a question that I was going to ask, because I had read statements to the effect that the law that you've been given to enforce is somehow antiquated in light of the job that you actually have to do. And it sounds like you wouldn't agree with that assessment.
I don't think so. And I think if you look at our track record carefully, we've never had to reach very far to find the violations and to use, for example, Section 10b-5 is one of the more flexible anti-fraud statutes out there. It covers a whole wide range of fraudulent activity from market manipulations to insider trading, and we use it just as effectively. I think what those people might be thinking more is it's clear that the Internet has made it easier for people to commit fraud. You can do it from your own basement, and it doesn't cost very much at all, and you can reach millions and millions of people without actually ever leaving your living room. But what people don't realize is that while it's certainly a lot easier to commit the fraud, it's also a lot easier to catch it if somebody puts their fraud on the Internet, just for two reasons. First, typically when you investigate a securities fraud, you start looking at the trading trail, you start looking at the money trail, and it's really, gumshoe detective work. Now you have this third trail, the Internet Protocol trail, that you can trace. So you have an additional means of tracking someone down and linking them to the violation. And then second, and this is even more important, is the resplendent evidentiary record that the Internet can provide. It makes it easier for me to present to my boss a potential violation. It makes it easier for me to present to the commission, to present to a judge. All the evidence is firsthand. I can show the offering materials to anyone to say, here's what was offered to the investor, as opposed to relying on what they said they were told. So while you might be able to reach more people on the Internet, one of those people is more likely to be us, the SEC. In fact, while I'm sitting here right now, I'm probably receiving spam and conducting SEC surveillance because I've visited so many of these sites that I'm on just about every one of these sucker lists that there is. And as a result, I get the promotions myself, as do lots of other SEC employees.
Well, you certainly don't seem like a sucker to me. Now, I would have assumed that perhaps people who are perpetrating the Internet frauds would be more technologically sophisticated than most of us, and that they might very well realize that they were leaving a trail, but it sounds like that's not necessarily the case. They may be as surprised to hear about this as anyone else.
Well, it's a mix. You know, some of them really don't know much about the medium. There's no composite. You know, sometimes the perpetrators are kids or young adults or young people. Sometimes they're much older. The SEC has charged a 15-year-old, Jonathan Lebed, with securities violations occurring over the Internet, and also a group of people led by a notorious securities recidivist, by the name of Clifford Noe. He and his brother Paul Noe and two others who were all over 70 perpetrated an internet fraud. That one involved Prime Bank Securities, the bogus instruments that purport to represent a secondary market for standby letters of credit. There's no such thing. And that fraud was around long before the internet came along. But generally, again, those kinds of frauds, whether someone has the technological ability, there have been a few cases in particular where people have really tried to hide their tracks, used everything from disposable cell phones and hacked into foreign relay servers to log on to the internet and used anonymizing software, visited anonymizing websites to try to cloak themselves. And we still always track people down. Remember that an internet con artist is not a hacker trying to tamper with the energy grid and hide between the cracks. The internet con artist, number one, has to collect money somehow if they're doing an offering fraud. So they're collecting, unless it's cash, which is very rare in a securities transaction, there's going to be a check or some sort of vehicle to move the money. And then secondly, for internet con artists, like a spam artist, for example, the more people they reach, the better. So if you're sending out 10 million spam, as I said, there's a strong likelihood that someone's going to report it to us.
Well, I think that I've heard you say that the internet does make committing fraud easier. Does that mean that you do think that there's been an overall increase in the number of frauds that are being both perpetrated and detected?
Well, I think some have certainly decreased. For example, the 17B violations that I mentioned. If any time you look at a spam in your email box, it's going to have the disclosure that's required. If it doesn't, you know, again, please send it to us. Actually, please send any spam to us, because you should never base any decision based on some piece of junk email that you receive. You should treat it like a paper placed under your windshield, your driver's windshield, your car's windshield, and just throw it away like a flyer. But I think that generally certain types of frauds have really, like the spam frauds, the market manipulations that occurred in the late 90s, are not as successful as they were. But on the other hand, I think more and more people use the internet every day, so you're going to see it as a part of a lot of different frauds, no matter what goes on, just like the telephone and the fax machine are a basic part of frauds, and when they first came along, they probably weren't.
I would assume that since the inception of your office in 1995, you have seen something like an exponential increase in the number of complaints that you receive.
That's really been incredible. When we set up the Enforcement Complaint Center, which is our online mailbox, which is really just an address, we sat around in a room, a bunch of people from the SEC, from the different divisions, and we thought, this was back in 1996 when I don't think most federal agencies did not have sort of an online infrastructure to accept complaints from the public. But we thought, let's try it and see what happens. So, and Bill McLucas in particular, he was the director at the time, and he was very enthusiastic about it. So we set it up by just creating a mailbox, and then we used some basic software in-house. We didn't spend any money to do it. And then we opened up the Enforcement Complaint Center, and we quickly realized, wait a minute, who's going to answer these emails and who's going to read them? But I was there, and I was happy to do it, and I thought it was interesting. So we started receiving, I received about 4 or 5 emails a day and set up a little autoresponder just to respond with, because all of our investigations are always non-public, we can't even really say to someone, hey, we will look into that. Because that would be telling them that we're investigating. What we can say is that we'll act in accordance with our responsibilities under the federal securities laws. So we put that together, and we thought it was important to sign someone's name to it. So I signed so that people realized that somebody was looking at these. And they came in about 4 or 5 emails a day, as I said initially. Then they grew to maybe 20 or 30 a day. And then when we had a few of the sweeps, they grew to 40 or 50 a day. And now they're up to between 5,000 and 6,000 a day. So our office receives about 5,000 or 6,000 emails every single day from concerned members of the public. And that's just the best way to receive leads, because there's a culture of vigilance on the internet. And I remember back then we sought to sort of tap into that. And it grows in everyone. When you're walking down the street or you go into a store and you feel like somebody's cheated you, you quickly go to the internet to try to solve it. You know, I'm going to email the CEO of the store. I'm going to email the Federal Trade Commission or the SEC. And I think the SEC is out there for anybody who sees anything securities fraud related, they tell the SEC. You see it on a message board. There might be a discussion of a stock and somebody might say something that seems suspicious, and someone will quickly respond, well, I'm going to email the SEC and tell you. So being able to tap into that, and people can rest assured that if they do send us an important lead or any lead, it is reviewed immediately within, you know, sometimes within a few hours, sometimes it might take a few hours more than that. But generally, we look at the stuff very quickly.
So there is, it sounds like there's a very efficient review process in effect. Do you all take turns? Or?
Yeah, we rotate around in different ways, and we have a very, very intense sort of triage process. And it's actually headed up by Dave Gianfrido, who helped me originally with the white paper back way back when.
We have a question from a listener, Ben Olson, who asked what the biggest challenge facing the SEC with online fraud is today, and how does the SEC plan to resolve it?
That's a good question. We're always, part of our office's mission, I think more than anything, is to try to look ahead and see what risks lie around the corner in the area of technology, and try to look for trends, try to spot anything that you see that might be growing. And I think what we've seen certainly over the last 6 months to a year is the growth of online intrusions, where you're combining identity theft, hacking, and securities fraud into one full scheme. And these schemes are fairly sophisticated. They involve different numbers of people, and different one person might do the electronic logging and get the virus program into someone's computer, so it logs their keystrokes and they figure out their password and they figure out their username to a brokerage account, and then they hack into the brokerage account, and then they may set up a third party to receive the funds and then funnel those funds via wire transfer to anywhere else in the world. And we have seen a rise in the number of complaints pertaining to those kinds of incidents, and it's always something that concerns us, so we quickly got together with our Office of Investor Education, which is another office a lot like ours that uses technology in brilliant ways to really spread to educate investors and to teach investors not only how to invest but how to protect themselves. So we put together a fairly extensive, what we call investor alert, that explains the kinds of things that people need to do to protect themselves. So hopefully this area we will continue to be vigilant. We have several investigations in this area too, and you know, hopefully again we'll catch these people.
That brings me to another question from a listener. This one from Jeremy Britton, the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. He asks, what can consumers do to protect themselves from brand spoofing, phishing, and identity theft via online methods? And follow up, if someone believes they have received fraudulent emails, what should they do and whom should they contact?
Well, that's another good question. The first, our email address is very simple. It's enforcement@sec.gov. You can email us directly, or you can go, we put a form together, a very basic form that you can fill out and submit that to us as well. And about, you know, we don't get as many of those forms, but people do let us know, as I said, very quickly. So I encourage everybody to email us whenever they feel even the slightly suspicious about any sort of securities fraud. What can a person do to protect themselves if they carry on brokerage transactions online? It's a tough question. We put a whole bunch of guidelines together in that investor alert, which includes encouraging people to put up firewalls, to guard their passwords with vigilance and change them a lot. And when I say firewalls, I mean security systems internally, software, and externally through a router or whatever mechanism you can use to protect yourself via hardware. Antivirus software is very important. Checking your statements every month. One of the things that we always say is if you just watch your statements carefully, you've got to make sure that everything seems to be going okay. Look at the SEC site and read carefully. One thing that I've seen some customers do is they use these tokens where their password changes every 10 seconds or so. We actually have them at the SEC with respect to using when we want to access our own email off-site. Things like that are useful as well.
Also related is a question from Elizabeth Ross in Florida International University, who generally was inquiring about what can be done to prevent tampering with statements on accounts. And it sounds to me as though your answer would be, well, for a starting point, make sure that you look at them regularly, which not all of us do.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, there's some basic lessons for investors that we've always preached for a very long time. The first is always, you know, do your homework when you make an investment opportunity, and do your homework when you choose your online brokerage. Make sure that you fully understand what sort of protections, if any, that they provide. And talk to people. You know, choose your investments like you would a doctor for heart surgery. Talk to people you trust and find out what systems they use and how they protect themselves. Don't trust anything that you just suddenly read on the internet, especially in a message board or spam, as the sole basis for your investment opportunity. Remember, information that comes to you over the internet, you have to worry about its integrity, meaning is the person who's telling you this objective or not? Do you know who this person is? And then even if you know who the person is and you're sure that their opinions are objective and you're sure that they're providing you good advice, how can you be sure that it's that person who's actually behind the keyboard clicking in the keys and making the investment recommendations? So you need to be extra careful in this regard. The information on the internet is a wonderful source for particularly public information like SEC filings. The investor relations sites of any public company are filled with just incredible amounts of information that 4 or 5 years ago just weren't available. And you can use all of that information, but it's still no substitute for being very, very careful and talking to someone you trust. And my view is always the same. I'm not going to take anyone's recommendation to make an investment unless I can look them in the eye.
Would you say that generally if you go out and, or you, if you make the effort of finding the information yourself by going to somebody's website, that you'll be a lot safer than if you accept something that somebody sends to you?
Well, absolutely. I mean, again, you know, anybody who sends you anything, you have to be suspicious of, because unfortunately, there is an unsavory portion of the population that are going to try to take advantage of you when your guard is down. And we all let our guards down. You go out, you know, you might go down to Georgetown for the weekend on a Saturday and think about that you're not going to buy anything, that you don't need anything, and you come home with something that you absolutely don't need, and you wonder what happened. You know, well, you let your guard down for a minute, and it can, you know, it particularly you log onto a screen and there's a million pop-ups that happen, and you accidentally hit OK, and the next thing you know, your computer's infected with something that's scrambling your whole screen, and that's happened to me, and I'm certainly one of the most careful computer users out there. So, you know, you really do have to watch your guard, because people will try to take advantage of you.
I'm interested in the demographics of the people who try to take advantage of you. I think that you said earlier that you'd seen an age range from 15 to well into the 70s, that the perpetrators of online fraud are not all the under 30 people who hang out at internet coffee shops that I might have previously suspected. Would you say that there's any age bulge at all toward the younger perpetrator?
Not really at all. And on the victim side, it really goes the same way. You know, we're always looking for, of course, there have traditionally been some categories of victim, like the elderly are often targeted, or certain affinity frauds might target a particular race or religion. But generally, both on the victim side and the perpetrator side, I've never really been able to come up with any form of composite. It's always, you just never know. And oftentimes we bring in people for testimony, and you see them for the first time, and they don't even look anything like what you expected. So I can't really say. You know, it's definitely an area that attracts all sorts of miscreants, the securities fraud area on the internet.
Equal opportunity?
Yes.
You mentioned online intrusion before, and that was an interesting, although terrifying concept. Can you describe some of the other typical schemes that you mentioned briefly, but if you could go into a little more detail for us about something I've heard about, the pump and dump. What is a pump and dump?
Well, there's lots of ways. Typically, pump and dump schemes involve what are called microcap securities, which are companies that are not much in terms of operations, thinly traded. There's not much to know about them. They may file audited financial statements with the SEC, but they're in some of the lower level marketplaces, they might not even do that. And those companies are subject to wild fluctuations in price, even from this, and they're also more susceptible to traditional market manipulations like wash trades and match trades, where you have the same person on both sides doing the trading, pumping up the price of the stock. And the idea is to generate enough buzz, and sometimes I see them as pure, like a spam campaign, perhaps combined with a message board campaign, perhaps combined with an old-fashioned boiler room where there are actual promoters calling investors to go and buy this stock. And all combining, sometimes they're all separate, sometimes they're all together, but just to raise the price of a stock artificially through some sort of hype, often in terms of the flavor of the month. The company might be, if Homeland Security is an important topic, it might have a new Homeland Security device that's going to revolutionize the airplane travel or airport security. You might see during the anthrax scares, there were a bunch of companies that suddenly emerged as these incredible companies that will somehow detect anthrax on your computer, they generate some buzz, get the stock price to go up, and they've previously acquired these shares at a very low price, maybe for free. Sometimes a company might hire one promoter who hires 10 more promoters who hires 10 more and just keeps passing out shares to everyone saying, you know, do what you can to get this stock price up, and you'll make some money because you can dump these shares too. And that's what happens, is that the unsuspecting investor who buys at the end of the pump and dump thinking they've got something. And we just did a case recently involving a company called Cameron International, which really wasn't much at all of a company. There was no headquarters. There was maybe one employee at most, and the stock went from 6 cents to $90.
My goodness.
Fortunately, we got in there before the dump. We actually suspended trading and then brought an emergency asset freeze with respect to some of the proceeds, and the stock stopped its trading somewhere in the 80s. But, you know, obviously this company was probably not even worth the 6 cents that it was trading at initially.
What sort of volume of interest would you say would need to be produced to drive the price up that much?
You know, in some instances, not much at all, because if you're using match trades or wash trades and you're just two buddies trading back and forth and somehow finding the appropriate brokerage to place these orders back and forth, or using nominee accounts, you might not need much at all to get the price up that high. And then once the flurry starts, once the momentum builds, you really never know how high it can go. And one of the earlier ones went to 15 cents went from 15 cents to $15 over a weekend. This was involving a company called NEI Webworld, which was a shell company both physically and metaphysically. Metaphysically, it was a shell company because it had no assets. Physically, it was a shell company because there was literally a building with NEI Webworld written on it that was gutted. A bunch of really young people got together on the West Coast and started spreading a bunch of false information about NEI Webworld, saying that they were going to be acquired over a weekend, and got the price up that quickly and dumped their shares. But we caught them very quickly, and they were also, like many of our cases, prosecuted criminally as well. And the Internet program is one of those programs that has a real interest from criminal authorities. So oftentimes when we're working an investigation, there's a parallel investigation going on from criminal prosecutors across the country.
Sounds like the permutations are, if not endless, extremely varied. Do you have a favorite case you might share with us?
Well, I think one case that comes to mind is a recent case that involved hacking, involved a 19-year-old by the name of Von Dinh. And what Von Dinh did, he owned a bunch of Cisco put options that were about to expire worthless. And they were way out of the money, so there was really no chance that he was going to make anything from it. And what he did was he hacked into the account of an innocent brokerage customer and orchestrated a bunch of buy orders for these worthless put options from the hacked-in account and made himself a very, very quick profit. Now, this was, to track him down was actually, it was fairly easy because even though he had taken very significant steps to cloak his behavior, which his actual online behavior, the trading in the Cisco put options was the only trading to occur during that period. So the only trades were these trades, and they really made no sense. The ingenuity of the case struck me as something that I had never seen before. But even more so was sort of the brazen nature of Von Dinh. I think even in speaking to him when he spoke to us over the telephone initially when we were investigating, he really didn't seem intimidated or nervous at all. I think he absolutely believed that we would never catch him in a million years. But we did, and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston brought their own criminal proceeding against him, and he went to prison.
I think that there's a moral in there someplace. It's pretty clear what it is. Mm-hmm. Was that particular case identified by the person whose account was hacked?
Yeah. In fact, that person got in contact. One of the other things about the Internet program that's unique that I like about it is you work a lot with the other divisions at the SEC. We have a Division of Market Regulation, Division of Corporation Finance, Division of Investment Management. Investment Management is primarily mutual funds. Market regulation involves broker-dealer regulation, other regulated entities, and corporation finance, of course, involves public offerings. And the Internet program really oftentimes has to work with those other divisions to figure out when things are a violation, because it's almost like Internet fraud violations that you find on the Internet are like driver's ed films. They have every conceivable violation in them, and you just have to figure out what's most appropriate to charge. And that particular complainant called our Division of Market Regulation and reported that their account had been hacked. And, you know, it's a tough one because you wake up one morning and all your money is gone, and you've got to figure out a way to find someone to believe you, that you didn't just make these trades on yourself and lose money, mm-hmm. and that you're not just trying to get around that. And that's important. You have to, with every complaint that comes in, you have to have you have to be engaged, but you also have to be careful that someone isn't trying to use the complaint system for their own advantage. But in this instance, my deputy chief, Tom Sporkin, very quickly analyzed the volume, and I was on the road at the time and called me right away and said, you know, this is a real problem, and I don't think this person just is trying to masquerade losses. I think this person was really hacked into, and I think we need to look into it right away. That's the lesson. You always want a deputy chief that's a little smarter than you are.
In addition to reliance on the complaints that come in from the other divisions or through the website, what other ways do you have of seeking out fraud?
Well, initially we got very creative, particularly when Dick Walker was director. He was very excited, and even Steve Cutler also, when he became director after Dick Walker, both of them were very excited about finding ways to surf the Internet and try to automate somehow our surveillance. And we started out, we did things like surf days where we would actually work with other federal agencies and spend these days where everybody would surf the Internet and use different search terms or different areas of the Internet and report back the violations and refer the matters to one another. And those were pretty successful for a while, the surf days. Then we had, we actually enlisted in the early days, we had something called the Cyber Force, which, looking back, seems like a very goofy name. But at the time,
better than Geek Squad.
Yeah. At the time, I went around the country with Joe Sella, the head of our market surveillance group, and we talked to people about Internet surveillance. And then we had training in Washington and in some of the other regions where we told people how to surveil and gave them some tips. And then we would have our own internal sort of surf days, and every office would have certain people that would check the Internet every day. And that was a useful way, too, because most of the time, the most important function of surveillance is the person doing the surveillance. You need somebody with a good amount of skill at detecting fraud and knowing when something is worthy of resources, because not every violation warrants a federal case or federal resources. There are lots of other resources that might be interested in it, or it might not even be somebody that intends to commit fraud. It might be someone who just doesn't know what they're doing and made a mistake, and it's important to be able to differentiate that. And if it's someone who's just making a mistake and it's a more technical violation, to figure out a way to perhaps work with that person, and again, allow the technology to flourish and use your resources for the people, the really bad people who are trying to spoil the internet for the rest of us. So the next step, and this is something Congress got involved in, was and Chairman Arthur Levitt got involved in, was actually taking surveillance to a new level and automating it. So we worked with an outside contractor and actually built an internet search engine. And we used that for several years, and we enjoyed some success with that. Where we would pick up certain potential violations, and every month they would dump these websites into a server, and then Internet OIE, Office of Internet Enforcement staff, would then review these leads and use the triage. And most of the time, the value of those leads was that they related to existing investigations. Most good leads that come in, we're already looking at that. But the important thing is to get that information as quickly as you can to the attorney or accountant who's examining that, who's looking, who's investigating that potential violation. So we used the search engine for a while, and then that contract expired, and we thought, you know, really we're an agency of people, and people do the best work when it comes to this. And on top of that, the Enforcement Complaint Center had grown to such a tremendous size and had become such an incredible source of leads that we decided to devote our resources to that. And it's interesting because we came full circle. When the SEC first started, and pretty much throughout its entire history, the number one source of leads has always been from members of the public. So it's only natural that as the internet progressed, that sort of enhanced our ability to connect with people and then get those leads. And I think where we tried, we made some, I think, pretty bold, and you know, both Dick Walker and Steve Cutler were very creative in trying to say, let's figure out new ways to find these violations. But in the end, we decided, you know, people reporting to it is to us is the best way. And that's really worked out, and it's something it's forever. It's like the mail, you know, and it, like the ordinary mail, just keeps coming and coming and coming, and you never know what you're going to get when you open up your complaints for the day.
As you said before, not everything merits a federal case. Is there some magic number as far as dollars are involved, some matter that might be too small to be of interest?
I don't think that's necessarily how we look at it. I think that's, of course, going to be something we think about. But really what you're looking at is the scienter, the state of mind of the person who's perpetrating the violation. And if something involves any form of lying, cheating, or stealing, we're going to want to get to the bottom of it. What I'm talking about more is the person who has never done a securities offering and then just decides to put it up on their website one day. I don't think it's necessary. If you can call that person up and say, look, we've got some issues with your website, and they are willing to work with whatever operating division there is, whether it be corporation finance or market regulation, that's one way to use resources as best you can and not to make a federal crime, a federal case out of every violation. We call it the Early Intervention Program, where when we identify websites that we don't necessarily want to refer to other agencies and we don't think the person is necessarily of that really bad state of mind or even any indicia of a bad state of mind, we refer the matter over to the Division of Market Regulation or the Office of Corporation Finance, and then they actually call up that issuer and say, look, you need to take your website down because we have some issues here, so we'd ask that you would take it down. We'll work with you, again, in trying to help you in terms of compliance with the securities laws. But otherwise, if you're if you if if we begin to get really suspicious about this, we're going to refer it back to the enforcement division, and then the enforcement division will investigate. And that's all part of the basic theme. Just about all of the cases, almost every single case that we've ever brought in the internet area has involved fraud. And we're very proud of that because, again, one of the first things that inspired me to become a part of all of this was that the commission was going to do everything it could to get out of the way of the technology so that it can flourish, so that the marketplace, free markets, so that everyone can benefit. And really the policing is going to deal with people who are trying to exploit it and try not to get into the way of the many, many different types of opportunities the internet offers for businesses, for investors, for big corporations, to let them all take advantage of those opportunities. And at the same time, keep the internet safe so that investors can feel somewhat confident about what they're looking at.
It sounds then as though you would be, I think quite legitimately, much more excited about and interested in schemes that involve fraud as opposed to the mere sale of unregistered securities.
I mean, there have been cases, for example, there were a bunch of offerings done on eBay that violated, that there were clear Section 5 violations. And we brought those cases very quickly. And eBay was extremely helpful in understanding what we were doing and cooperating with us. And I think we needed to make a statement that people can't sell stock over eBay. And I don't necessarily know what – so that was a pure Section 5 violation. And there have been some of those cases when we really feel like the internet – is being, it's a dangerous phenomenon that's growing. There was a phenomenon in the late 90s where people were selling free stock on the internet, and we brought a bunch of those cases because there were a lot of problems with offering free stock on the internet. Most of the time it wasn't free. They were charging you something. And we even, you know, there was a case recently our office did involving Ford Credit, where they were marketing online debt securities where they have sort of these, they called them at the time money market accounts, but they really weren't. They're secured by Ford Credit. And they had gotten, in what we believe, too aggressive in their marketing. And they had, in our view, violated Section 5. And we ultimately settled with them, and they paid a penalty. And a big component of that, and we had gotten the complaint online, was that the website was used in many ways to market that investment opportunity in ways that were inconsistent with Section 5.
It sounds like your practice has involved some quite novel issues. Have you ever had a situation in which a person didn't even realize that the thing that they were touting was a security?
Yeah, I think people like to – there's two types. You know, there are some – again, and this was more in the late 90s and maybe 2000 where people would say, I didn't know that – this was a security, or I didn't know that the SEC was involved. But I think nowadays we've been pretty aggressive with our cases. We've been pretty aggressive in education. And sometimes people will say that when we investigate, but you never really know whether something is a security until you dig into it. And, you know, in my course, it takes a long time to teach what a security is. So I can have some sympathy for someone who says, I didn't think it was a security, but they need to convince me that they're being genuine.
What percentage of the cases that either you identify or wronged investors identify for you actually result in the filing of charges, would you say?
That's tough to say. It really is. Because, you know, you might get 3,000 spam complaints in the course of a day pertaining to one company, so in a case that you do. So it's almost misleading to say that that involves one case. It's really tough to say what percentage. In the end, you know, most of the complaints that we receive of the 5,000 a day, we can either are duplicative, because quite a lot of them are duplicates, or we can we refer out, as I said, to state agencies. Under Steve Cutler, we developed a fairly aggressive program of referring matters to the states. And that's another thing about the internet that's that's really terrific is it's brought law enforcement together on so many different levels. We work with all of the states, and everybody has an interest because oftentimes so many things, since there's no borders, everybody has to work together. And it actually trickles over to the international area because I've spent a lot of time with our Office of International Affairs, and we've had quite a few detailees in our office from foreign countries because, again, everyone is inspired to stop fraud. So I'll be speaking at a conference to maybe a group of 75 countries, and half of these countries would be ones I would never want to visit and certainly whose philosophies I don't agree with. But we find common ground. You know, everybody wants to have a marketplace that has integrity to it and that will flourish. And if you've got a marketplace rife with fraud, it won't. So you've got to work hard to make your capital markets work. And part of that is making sure that the fraud on the internet doesn't occur in your country. So it is a remarkable level of cooperation between countries. It just keeps getting better and better and better. And I think that it's almost diplomacy because you end up working so closely with these countries that you have a sincere desire to help them when they give you a call. And it gets even more personal when the people are detailed in our office and then go back to whatever country they're from and call us for help. Because on both sides, in one instance, we brought a case, I can't remember which one it was, where we got the Internet Service Protocol information, the ISP, Internet Service Provider information, the IP trail, the electronic footprints that the perpetrators had left, faster from an Australian Internet Service Provider than from another Internet Service Provider on our own soil. That's how good the cooperation can be.
And in the international realm, we have a question from listener Jay Allen. I'd be interested to know how much of the U.S. online securities fraud problem originates outside of the U.S. Much of the illegal offer traffic in Europe seems to come from non-European countries, as evidenced by the poor grammar and spelling of the spam and pop-ups, if nothing else. Are you getting that sort of sourcing there? Is this truly a worldwide phenomenon?
It is worldwide, and it certainly fluctuates. I see more in sort of the Eastern European markets lately with respect to the online intrusions. But I have found, particularly with these prime bank instruments, which are completely phony, there's no such thing. You see a lot of those come from all different parts of Europe. So it's tough for me to pinpoint any particular area. But I do think it's growing internationally. It creates challenges for us. But lucky for the SEC, you have this Office of International Affairs that they spend their time building the bridges between countries, either through memorandums of understanding, formal treaties, or just relationships. And they've become such a critical part of the SEC's infrastructure. And, you know, as I said, the SEC is really an agency of people. There's not a lot more to us than the 3,800 or so employees that work there and about 1,200 or so work in enforcement. So you spend a lot of time just working with your colleagues, trying to team up to figure out the best way to solve these problems. I mean, that's the best part about working at the SEC on that point is the people. It's in many ways, since I'm here at the SEC Historical Society and a lot of the people tuning in might be former SEC employees, I think everybody shares the common view that it's like a family there. And it's not just the spirit of public service that drives employees at the SEC. It's a great way to come to work, to think that you're doing good every day. I spent a couple years at a law firm before. I've been at the SEC 15 years. I spent a couple years at a law firm beforehand, and I couldn't picture myself going back, although so many people do. I just think whenever anybody leaves, they always say, I'm really going to miss the people here. And there is a culture within the SEC of not just wanting to protect investors, of not just wanting to make the world a better place, of not just doing meaningful work, but about caring for your colleagues and caring for making your colleagues more like your friends. Not that, you know, everyone feels that way, but I think most of us do.
It sounds as though the investors of America are in good hands and have something to feel quite happy about. On that note, though, I would be interested in following up on what your policy generally is with subsequent follow-up with investors. That is, you've told me what the initial response to them would be. If you decide that the complaint that they have made isn't something ultimately that the SEC is able to pursue or really refer anyone, is there any closure for the complainant?
Sometimes, unfortunately, there isn't, and that's probably the most frustrating part for the investor, and it's frustrating for us also. But you have to protect the integrity of the investigative process. So if an investor calls me and says, hey, I emailed you, I got your standard response, I want to know what you're doing about my problem. And I might very well be doing a lot about it, but I can't comment. Or if I'm doing nothing about it, I can't comment. And I can imagine that investors, again, can feel very frustrated by that. But they have to have some degree of faith that, that we are very responsible in what we do, and that if there is some sort of fraud, that we're either trying to uncover it ourselves, we're referring it to another agency, we're working with criminal prosecutors, we're doing it as best as we can to solve the issue. But it's not fair during the investigative process, in my mind. In my mind, there's nothing as sacred as the investigative process, period. And the, you should never... It's an incredible taint on a person to say, to announce to the world that you're investigating them when you haven't filed any papers or you haven't charged them with anything. I can't imagine anything more. In my mind, I just think that's dead wrong. So for us, when if you're going to call up and say, are you investigating this person, unless we've charged them in some public forum, we're not going to say or make a comment on it just to protect the non-public nature of the investigative process. And that's a philosophy that's deeply ingrained at the SEC. And I'm sure that it's incredibly frustrating for investors because they want justice and they want it fast and they're entitled to that. But we're going to be careful, we're going to be deliberate, and we're always going to be thorough. But we're just not going to make any comment. And, you know, and that's not going to change. Certainly if it changed, I'd be out the door, but I don't think it ever will. I noticed our commission is very, very protective over our investigative process. And I think this new commission, it's a very exciting group of commissioners, a very engaged and enthusiastic chairman, and there are incredible things going on at sort of every corner of our new building. And, you know, one of the things that you touched on before, what should we be doing as far as proactively, you know, we have this great website, but we're going to be thinking of ways to get even more messages out to investors and to reach out to more investors even more, because we need, our focus always has to be the bottom line. How can we protect investors better? And that involves enforcement, bringing cases, which is aggressive prosecution. It involves surveillance, finding out what's going on. It involves self-policing, tapping into the public and finding out what they're thinking. It involves liaison work, working with every possible other agency, trying to leverage resources. Sometimes you really have to figure out ways to do more with less. But I always say, when you need something done, you give it to a busy person. So no matter how busy we are, we'll just do more. But liaison work, prosecution, surveillance, self-policing, all of those things are important components to use to sort of circle the wagons to make our markets the best and the most free on the planet.
Again, that is definitely an inspiring thought, and I think that many investors would feel very, you know, comforted by that. I'm going to be a little pedestrian, though, and follow the money for a minute. That is, I can imagine an investor thinking to themselves when they pick up the paper and see that you actually have filed against someone, thinking, oh, great, this means I'm going to get my money back. How often does that really happen?
Not as often as we would like. Certainly the commission itself, and when I say the commission, I mean the chairman as well, one of our top priorities is always, and certainly recently, to get money back into the hands of investors in any way that we can. And Sarbanes-Oxley created this whole opportunity for fair funds where the penalties can go into pools for investors. And we're going to work, I mean, we are working tirelessly to get that money back to investors. In the most outrageous frauds, the best thing we can do is get to court as quickly as possible to freeze assets. We're not always able to do that. Oftentimes, where we just don't find out about the fraud quickly enough. The great thing about the internet program, and a lot of the cases we do don't make headlines and people don't hear about them, because we've actually brought cases where no money has been raised, a real preemptive strike, where the fraudulent website has been up there, we saw it, and we brought a case. And certainly people in my office that bring those cases are very excited about them. But there's not a lot of blood on the floor to talk about. But I think those are terrific cases to do, where we can get out in front. And we've also, in our office, frozen assets, and what you do is you find a way through the disgorgement process. If you can do it internally in the SEC to save money and not hire some consultant to do it, you'll try it that way. If you have to, you'll use a very, very, very scrutinizing vetting process to pick the right consultant or distribution agent or however to help you get that money back to investors. And I can't emphasize enough how much of a priority that is for every single staff member in the division to figure out in any fraud how best to get that money back to investors. It's just tough, though. Sometimes the money's gone, and we just can't get it back to them. And many times we have these giant outstanding judgments against people, but they have no money. And so the judgments sit there uncollected because the person is penniless, and you can't get blood from a stone.
That's right, or a turnip, I've heard, either one. And I was also thinking in terms of the penny saved is a penny earned, and certainly a fraud prevented seems to me to be just as valuable as one that's detected after the fact.
My mother has always been proud of our cases where no money was raised. So even though people might not necessarily be patting us on the back, there's always somebody to say that it's worth doing.
It sounds as though your division engages in a great deal of balancing and making a great number of very nuanced decisions. I've always been curious about how the determination is made whether to pursue an administrative remedy or to institute a judicial proceeding.
It's not always so easy to describe. I think in general, the more outrageous the fraud, the more likely you're going to be in federal court. If it involves a regulated entity, you might, like a broker dealer, and the allegations don't involve fraud, or an investment advisor and it doesn't involve fraud, you might be in an administrative forum. Oftentimes you combine the two because certain remedies are only available administratively, like barring a person from being a broker-dealer for life might only be available in certain contexts administratively, or you might feel it more appropriate to seek that remedy administratively. The administrative law judges at the SEC have tremendous expertise in the field of securities regulation. So when you make your decision might be more along the lines of, we need to be in a forum where the judge clearly understands this very technical violation. Some of our office's cases that have been brought administratively for recently involved electronic communication networks and some of the more technical investment advisor cases.
Well, I think that I'm certainly going to sleep a little better tonight based on what I've heard today, but I also know I'm going to be much more careful about some of my computer hygiene practices. Before we close today, I'm going to ask you a question that I think is sort of a public service. What advice would you give to someone who might aspire to do what you're doing?
Well, I tell my students that I think commitment to the areas of securities regulation is where you start. So if you're a law student and it's something that you're interested in, take as many courses as you can relating to securities regulation. If you're a college student, take as many accounting courses or finance courses that you can. Think about topics. There are so many things to write about nowadays. So if you're doing a thesis for a course, make sure that you do a thesis that has to do with what's going on in the marketplace today. Read the paper, read the financial press every day. It's not something I had the maturity to do in law school, but once I got into it, I really became pretty dedicated to reading keeping up with the SEC. And areas of broker-dealer activities, accounting activities, we take all types at the SEC, but the general thing that I like to see is somebody who almost felt like they were born to do this. Not that I ever was, but someone who is really committed to this area and has devoted parts as certainly their studies and their professional life to it.
And it sounds like basic computer literacy might be a fine addition to the package,
that,
too.
If I can find somebody who combines law enforcement, securities regulation, and computer proficiency together in one package, I don't think I've ever found that. That person is certainly ready. We'd love to hire that person.
John, thank you so much for the insights that you've shared with us today. We've all been vastly enlightened. I would like to remind our audience that this fireside chat is now archived by audio tape at www.sechistorical.org. The transcript for the chat will be ready soon. Please join us again next week, Tuesday, April 4th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for our next fireside chat, this one on the roots, challenges, and successes of EDGAR, the SEC's online filing system. Our panelists will include David Koffenhofer of Bound & Company, Inc., and Amy Goodman of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, LLP, both former staff members who worked on the development of EDGAR, along with Jack Katz, a former SEC secretary who witnessed the growth of EDGAR to its current use. Thank you for being with us today.